outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
This is Kyle Rice, and welcome back to another edition of The God Journey and this interesting series of Wayne and Sarah unpacking their story and really sharing what God has been up to over the last 6-8 weeks and just the incredible journey that the two of them have been on. Today, we have Sarah Jacobson in the studio with us. Sarah, I have to say, I'm so excited to have you here. I can't believe that we are in the process of telling this story right now.
I agree with that. I can't believe that. But I got to tell you that I am nervous. But
that's understandable.
But I know this is something that I want to do, and hopefully it will be a point of encouragement to someone else out there.
Well, let's start there, Sarah. What was it about sharing your story and potentially sharing it very publicly? Why was that valuable for you? Why were you wanting to take that risk?
As I was learning and summing these, looking up the stats and, you know, initially when I especially was heard that, you know, or knew that I had been childhood sexual molestation, and seeing the stats on that, and you know, 1 out of 3 women, or 1 out of 5 boys by the time of 18 have been through this, that there's 42 million people in the United States alone who have suffered from this. And, you know, 90% of those are basically done by people that you know. Knowing and reading that and seeing that, it's just like, okay, I know I'm not alone. I am now part of a, I am part of a group that I never thought I was a part of. Not to be labeled in a bad way, but it's part of my history.
Yeah.
It has to become part of my history because it's there, whether I like it or not.
Yeah.
So, and identifying with that and reading, you know, knowing, you know, my physical ailments and how through the years that I was feeling that, but misplacing the cause of it. And the suicidal tendencies, you know, of how, you know, how high the suicidal rate is for people who have been through this too, and how the devastation of and the toll that it can take, and how few people talk about it.
Yeah.
And I know that bottom line is I wanted to be validated. I wanted to be, it helps to tell it, to process it, first of all. And I keep asking, Wayne, are you getting tired of hearing about the trauma? I just like, it's,
you know, and,
but it helps, you know, because there's a lot of things now I don't talk about the initial ones, and eventually I'll get to the point where it's a story to just, it's just relaying a story about me. And that will be eventually what it is. I want people to know me, because it's a part of me, and they may not like what they hear or know. And I want to integrate that by talking about it and sharing it. It takes my trauma, puts it into my, helps me to rewrite my history, my story, and not let my trauma run my life. So it's part of that. And part of it is just trying to encourage others who, I mean, what, I had this for 64 years, you know, that, you know, I'm a smart person, but how could I be that smart if I had this inside of me and not know it? That to give some kind of encouragement or hope or, well, that makes sense. You know, it's just like, a, you know, somebody hears maybe be, I've heard some stories from on YouTube and stuff, and there'll be one word or one phrase in that I will hear, and that puts a light bulb in. And that's just like, that's, oh, I'm not crazy. I'm not alone in this.
One of the things I say too about is that this is a way to take back your life from the perpetrator. And I think that's true for Sarah. You know, as long as it's in the dark and it's hidden and it's shamed and you shouldn't talk about it, it makes other people uncomfortable, then the perpetrator still owns you, even though he's long dead and gone. But when you own the memory and you own the history of it, And you realize this doesn't redefine who I am as a person. Who I am as a person is emerging from this, but I'm taking my story back. And I see that happening for Sarah. Sarah very much wanted to do this. And I think it will help a lot of people who've never had this kind of an honest story exposed quite this way. And those are the stories that have encouraged Sarah. I mean, she's heard a TED Talk or she's heard something where someone has survived this. It gives such hope to her. And so I think she wants that voice, so she told me, available to others.
Yeah.
Well, and it's interesting because I think, especially in light of what's been going on in the institution of Christianity over the last 6 months to a year, as there's been a lot that's been coming out that we haven't been holding a safe space. Believers haven't been holding a safe space for people who have navigated that trauma. Instead, they have reinforced or helped cover up what the perpetrator was doing, instead of being that safe refuge for people to really process that story and allow God to do his healing work.
And that's kind of be devastating for people too, if it's been covered up. And that's a whole nother level of part of the trauma.
Yeah.
That's re-traumatizing people, right? Yeah. You know, there was a pastor in Toronto that I was with a few years back. He was just arrested a couple months ago for sexual indiscretions with people on the staff at the church. And this is a well-known megachurch in Toronto. And it just, that stuff hides everywhere. And people, I think, particularly in the Christian world, probably every Boy Scouts did it. You hide it, you cover it up because it's too embarrassing and it's just public relations for the organization instead of, you know what, got to take some stuff out of the dark. When you get it into the light is where stuff heals. It doesn't heal in the dark.
And it's so hard because I've talked with people that have and helped people navigate similar type situations. And several of them have been afraid to even talk to me because they're like, what's the point? There is no change. Like there's no change that happens. There's no safety that occurs. Like I'm still in the situation, you know, that type of thing. And sadly, having been in the mental health system, I've seen it happen where there's been a report that's been made and there was a child that was at risk. And for whatever reason, the system broke down and that child was still not able to get out of that situation or that person wasn't able to get out of that situation. And it just
needs to be addressed because you have all these mass shootings, how, you know, you have no idea if any or what was transpired to them. You know, you have the Olympic, the gymnast, you know, who, I mean, it's everywhere and it's all, and that's, you know, not even taking account what happens all over in the world. And
yeah, get to sex trafficking and war and
so pervasive.
The inhumanity of man to humanity to humanity is just really, it's so sad. Yeah. But you can heal. If you've been a part of this, this is where the light of God gets to shine into dark places. And these are the very dark places God wants to shine his light so that people can be whole. And what somebody did to you doesn't have to define you. It doesn't have to own you anymore.
Okay. Well, Sarah, you had done quite a bit of prep work to lay the stage for sending me a text message. So Wayne, the first couple of podcasts that we did, Wayne had shared a little bit of his story about what had happened when he first came, got back to Los Angeles, his experience of getting your text message. And then we really, really unfolded what happened in that time before I came out to LA and kind of what was going on his side of things and the different questions he was wrestling with and some of the things that God was sharing with him in the midst of that time, the people that were supporting him. And so I just want to invite you, give you an opportunity to share a little bit of your side of the story in those 3 weeks. Give us a little bit of perspective in those 3 weeks as you're preparing for Wayne to land. Knowing your heart for Wayne and knowing that you still, in the midst of this, deeply loved him, but felt like you needed to make a very, very hard and very risky decision. Where were you at when Wayne was preparing to land in Los Angeles? What was going on in your world?
Oh, gosh. I was just sick inside. I I was encouraged to just shut off my phone and watch a movie and put it in the hands of some other people who were doing some things. And I honestly not sure. I was just taking one minute at a time, and I was so torn inside. I was trying to imagine what he would be feeling like and would be going through, and then that just took me in probably a very dark space. I did a lot of pacing back and forth, and just was really pretty well sick inside, literally in my stomach. I just knew what I did. It's a hard way to describe or even to figure out myself. And even now, what has transpired, it's hard for me to kind of think back on that too. I do, but it's all looked at in my eyes. I see it through a different lens too. So I've kind of reshaped some of that too. So that's kind of hard. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers what you're saying. I was just torn. All I knew is I had decided to do this, and I was there, and those 3 weeks or whatever, I just was going day by day, and I wasn't planning for a lot of future things. You know, I was just trying to get through each day.
So Sarah, could you give us just a little bit of background or just kind of a synopsis of what led up to the point of you saying that this is my only way out, that I need to take this space, that I need to make this hard separation in the way that you did?
Because I was inside for quite a while, I was inside waging war inside me. I was in pain. I had made assumptions about that pain and knew that that pain and felt like that pain was not going to be able to ever change unless I did something.
Yeah.
And I knew that outside also I was feeling at, because of some of the assumptions I was making and conclusions about what was causing that pain, that I was having to maneuver around life day to day, feeling like I was having to walk on eggshells. And there was so much pain inside and outside. I was battling everywhere and was tired and just not wanting or seeing at that time options to do except either kill myself or leave Wayne. And at that time, that's just all I could see, because I'm experiencing feeling I'm this whole horrible person. I'm feeling all this pain and not knowing about something that was internally inside of me. And so I just deducted, you know, what I thought the problem was. Yeah, I struggled. I mean, I was at a very serious crossroad in suicidal path. Mm-hmm. And somehow or other, I mean, I didn't wake up one day, but I mean, I just somehow or other, and it has to either be God or some meds that doctor had put me on, and I decided not to do that route. And still the other route was to leave Wayne, and I battled with how I had to do that, and can't describe the shame, the guilt, the begging myself and God and to change things, but it's not changing. And so I did what I felt at that time, that's what I had to do in order to save myself. And I just, even as I was doing and preparing, I just like, how can I do this? Yeah. And even when I drove off that day, it's just, how can I do this? And, but yet I just did.
Yeah.
At that point when I made that decision, it was just like auto drive.
Yeah.
And so where I just did what I needed to do and didn't try to, and I couldn't, I wasn't making plans or thinking about, you know, what I'm going to do tomorrow. It was just trying to get through today.
The point that you were at that led you to that decision, I mean, you were in sheer survival mode, right? Like it was sheer life or death. How to either I end my life or I make some very drastic decisions that I need to be able to create some space, to be able to even give yourself a chance to breathe again. Am I hearing you right in that?
Yeah. But I'm not sure if I really understood that. Maybe I did at that time, that was survival mode. I think I understand that more now looking back, but I'm not sure if I was thinking that in my mind that clearly at that point in time. I just, once I made that decision that I wasn't going to kill myself, that I had reason to stay alive, that's the only thing I saw to do at that time.
So I want to explore a little bit. We can explore some of the trauma stuff and some of the other things that are coming up, that have been coming up a little bit later, Sarah. But what in those 3 weeks, Wayne talked a little bit about the tending the garden and some of the things that God was speaking to him during that time and during the challenging process that he was going through on his side. How was Father taking care of your heart? What did your time with Father look like? What were the conversations that you and Father were having during those 3 weeks as you were taking it day by day and figuring out what the next steps of life were going to look like?
There were some new songs I had. Just a few people that I was touching base with, and I was... we had extensive, long conversations with these, and I was going through and telling them what I was feeling and leading up to that, and we were all praying, and 'cause I just kept saying to them, I said, I know I love him. I know I love him. I know I love him. But I just had to do that. And then that was something that they just, they prayed and we talked. And then I had some songs, and some songs were given to me. I don't know what the names of them are right now, but I would just sing and I would just listen. And I would just, pray. And I think it was about a week or so later, I was meeting a girlfriend down at downtown Disney, and the hours at which I was driving was, just LA traffic. And it took me 2 or 3 hours. It took me, I think, 2 hours to get down there and 3 hours to get back. And there was just a couple songs, and I would listen to them, and I would be praying, and I would be singing, and I just focused on him. I've struggled often with Father's grace and love, and so I just, some of them, it's just, I want to be, it was about drawing near, and my healing and was always in his Father's hands, and one of them was just, I just want to be where you are. And that's all I could say for days, that's just singing those, and it was just sitting, and a lot of crying and then talking with, you know, friends again, you know, for hours. And I would just letting them kind of help carry me. I don't know if that makes sense. I mean, and then I was sad, you know, did I make the worst decision in my life? You know, have I ruined my life? And how you go back on that, but I couldn't imagine going back because the pain wasn't gone. I mean, I was okay alone. I had one dog and take walks, but it's just like, I mean, it was just everything. I honestly didn't get a bowl on the counter down, fill up with some oatmeal and put water in and heat it up, took every bit of strength that I had. And I didn't do anything like that for 2 or 3 days. I think finally it was 2 or 3 days. I survived a lot on potato chips, Fritos, and chocolate.
Absolutely.
Good diet, right?
Absolutely.
And that was kind of off and on. I visited a girlfriend for a weekend. I don't remember which weekend it was. And that we had a lot of chocolate and potato chips and chips. For a while, it was just to take a shower. Didn't care like doing that, to brush my teeth, having a dog kept me out walking and feeding and having to get up because I'm in an apartment and then I have to take her out in the morning. So it got me up and out, but it was just took everything just to even try to get any motivation to do anything and a lot of sitting. And so that's about, there wasn't anything kind of planning. It was basically just trying to get through a day.
When did you start to feel that shifted for you, Sarah? When did you start to feel like there was some change or just some flow of life back into you in the midst of this time?
As far as eating wise, it took a while. And even when I was up with my friends, I don't know, I think it was mainly oatmeal survived, but simple things. To function with the dog helped, helped me get out. Having, I go to the gym, and so that at least got me out and some sort of energy to keep going. But I don't know if I really saw maybe 2 weeks or so. Abby was having some difficulties and just life. And
that's the other dog for people who don't know.
Yeah. And
that's the dog I got left with.
Trying to help take care of her, and just in life and just bills, trying to keep ahead. It took me 2.5 weeks before I even felt like doing laundry. I don't know if I really, little bit by little bit, I forced myself, I guess, to do things. The grandkids and going and seeing baseball game. I think I went to one or two in that time. Motivation and to just get up was, it took everything. And my trainer at the gym, she was, she knew that the strength was not there. So we did a lot of things to help just stretch and take care of myself. And so, just to take my pills, I was just like, oops, I forgot. Oh, well, I'll take those tomorrow. it's when you're in that kind of state, it's just surviving is just, It's not easy.
I feel like so often we take for granted even some of those basic motivations. If you haven't been in a space where you're truly in crisis, where you're, there's almost this deep heart despair in some regards, not to mention navigating trauma and not even knowing, you know, what the trauma is that you're navigating, it's so easy to take for granted, even just those basic, the motivation for those basic skills.
Yeah.
So what were some of the messages or meaningful conversations that you had, or just things that stuck out to you between the time that that Wayne came home and the time that I flew out to Los Angeles?
The prayers, when I was on the phone with a couple of them, the prayers and the love and the non-judgmentalness that I got from people, because I fully expected I was going to be this bad person because of how I had done what I did. And I believed that was probably true. I mean, I what I did, because I struggled. I begged, and I wanted a different way to do it. People were loving and so caring and accepting and not judging and just saying, well, we love both of you. And the prayer and just the words and the love and the compassion that they held. I mean, it the non-judgmental, and it was a huge, huge thing for me. Because I expected and I believed, and maybe part of me thought I should be classified as this, the bad person, the uncaring, the rudeness, and even in the, I had written some letters to just a handful of people and had sent them a couple days after Wayne had gotten home. And even in writing those, I didn't know how, and I gave them the freedom to be able to, you know, I wasn't going to judge them on however they thought of me. And because I fully anticipated of being outcast or shunned.
And honestly, I think that to me anyway, that just again highlights A, the level of crisis that you were in, and B, the level of courage that you were willing to walk in. Because if you were willing to be shunned and judged and disregarded by even the people that you loved the most, but you felt like you still had to go there, you still needed to take those steps, that's significant, Sarah. That carries so much weight. I mean, to me, that just resonates as somebody who was willing to go there no matter what the consequences was, because you knew that that's what you had to do. Whether there was a better route or not, you knew that that's where you had to go.
Well, I gotta say, it didn't feel very courageous. And this whole process hasn't really felt very courageous.
I can understand that. As an outsider looking in, and having walked through this with both you and Wayne and been a part of this, that's been one of the things that has been highlighted to me a lot, Sarah, is just the level of courage that you have displayed in this and the level of risk that you've been willing to take, especially now knowing more of the level of the background and the extent of the trauma that you've experienced and what you've been working through. It took so much. It took so much risk and courage for you to step out and do that.
Yeah, I would say that, but I just had made a decision and I went, and that was it.
I admire, when I was asked the other day, what do you think, what's your biggest emotion with Sarah right now? And I said, this too, one is gratitude. I am so grateful this woman's back in my life. And the second was admiration. Yeah. I admire the courage of this woman to take on something that is huge, that she had not a hint of in the whole of her existence, except the symptoms of trauma are there. We can look back to our marriage now and go, the symptoms of trauma were there.
Yeah.
We didn't know, because Sarah doesn't have a traumatic memory that latch that could be explained by. So it'll be more fun when she gets to tell that part of the story. I had a list going on here on my legal pad that I use. It has three columns in it. One was life without Sarah. What do I need to answer? Life with Sarah. What do I want to do if she comes back? That's different. What do I need to be aware of and think about? That's where tenderness and all that stuff shows up. And then the other one was in limbo. How long do I live in limbo? And what does limbo look like? And because one of the things Sarah and I talked about was selling the house. So the house is for sale. We do. Sarah wants out of here. Even though we're all back together and things are good, Sarah's just like, there's too much property with some of her joint issues. Gardening on a hill is just beyond her. She wants flat space and she wants simpler, smaller, which I do too. So I've been thrilled, but it's on the market. So, man, what does that mean for me? Do I get an apartment? Do I just hit the road and just go spend time? If I'm not communicating with Sarah, I'd rather be hanging out with other people and do it. But I've got people here I want to hang out with too. So I've said this about those first 3 weeks of being disconnected from Sarah, and then the first 2.5 weeks of being somewhat connected, but not really knowing if this marriage is going to, and I even said to people, it will be a resurrection. This is not just going to, oh, we'll put it back together. No, this is going to be a resurrection. This is going to be all new. It's got to have to fit Sarah's wholeheartedness. We're discovering who Sarah is. And interestingly enough, she said to me the other night, we're going to bed. She turned to me, she said, you know what I want to do? I said, what do you want to do? She said, I want to fly a kite. I said, you want to fly a kite? I said, you've never flown a kite? She said, I've never flown a kite. I missed that. And I said, babe, we'll go get a kite. We'll go wait for a windy day. We're going to go fly a kite. You and me, we're going to do this.
Yeah.
I don't know what Sarah is part of, because what happens to Sarah happens at 4. And part of her emotions froze at 4. And some of the things how she relates to life is more like a 4-year-old that she's managed inside. And God gets to grow that up now. And part of that's play, love, rest, and play. And I'm in on the play. And man, it is so good. I've watched Sarah in the last 2 or 3 weeks belly laugh about things that I haven't seen her. And one thing that endeared me to Sarah in our dating life was how impish she could be. Kind of a tease, and I mean that in a really good way. Just you know, making fun and teasing about things, and kind of watching me getting and enjoying laughing at me if I do something funny or whatever. That's all come back, and I never thought I'd see that again. I haven't seen it in 10, 12 years probably, because this trauma in Sarah has been surfacing probably now. We look back for 15 years or more, and God has graciously. It emerged at the time when I guess we were best able to handle it. I don't know. I don't know if we'd known earlier, I don't know the answer to those questions. I just know we're here now. One of the things I saw this, I was probably 2 days into my agony. I was just praying and I saw this big planet. And I think I talked about this on the podcast about, no one knew what it was about, and I'm going by it like a little spaceship, going by this big planet. And the big planet bends the orbit. I'm going to orbit. It just bent me and sent me a different direction in the universe. And God said to me, this is changing the trajectory of your life, but it will lead to more beautiful spaces.
Yeah.
And I kept looking for a second spaceship. I would love to have seen Sarah's.
Yeah.
We're going to end up. I didn't know what beautiful places meant. I didn't know if that would mean without her. But right now, Sarah and I, and this will, you know, I laid everything down. I laid down the podcast. We only started it again because I felt like things were evening out enough with Sarah that we'd be okay. Yeah. But still, I would quit it tomorrow. If the next 20 years of my life, whatever we have left together, Sarah and I, is about Sarah finding her joy and her wholeness of heart. And if that means we take off in a motorhome and just tool around the country for a while. I don't know what that means for Sarah. She doesn't want to buy a home right away. She just wants to live a simpler, unattached existence. Not unattached to me, thank God, but unattached to, I mean, for the first time, when this house sells, we will not own any property anywhere on the planet, Sarah and I, and say, okay, now we're free. I told a group the other day that we're talking about this who was praying for me through this time too. I said, I feel like Abraham and Sarah, we're going out because we did buy an RV.
Yeah.
And we are going to sell this home and go. I don't know. It's a month, 2 months. I feel like Abraham, you know, we're just going out from the country that we've been having no idea. We may find a group of people out there to say, you know what? We could live here. We could settle right here and buy a home. That may happen. There's people want me to come visit. Sarah said, I want to visit too. Sarah wants to tell her trauma story because I have not coerced her. I took her seriously saying that was my last podcast. So she's had to fight me to get back. Are you sure? Because you know, if you share your story, people are going to want to talk to you. And the last time it was, you know, no contact. And she said, no. She said, this book, Try Softly, that I've been recommending, Sarah and I read it through. It was so healing. It was so wonderful. We got into so many good discussions. The last page of it, the woman is telling her trauma story, who wrote the book. Her trauma story is from her mom, who's an alcoholic for all of her life. And when she's dealing with the pain, the trauma and the abuse that came from her mom's alcoholism, she's reading that to her mom, the manuscript. And at the end of it, she asks her mom, do you mind if I publish this? Because her mom's through the book. Mm. And her mom said, you know what? And she's been 13 years sober now, her mom has. Okay. And they've really reconnected and things are wonderful. But she said, if this helps one person, it's worth it. Mm. And when I read that, that's the very end of the book. I looked up at Sarah. Sarah's got tears in her eyes. And she said, I want to tell my story. Mm. I said, seriously, like publicly? She said, I want to tell my story. I want people to know what I did to you. I want people to know what God's doing in me. And I said, you know, there's going to be people who want to talk to you. And she said, you know what? I want to help people who are stuck in trauma. I want to encourage them to get the resources they need. And I'm like, okay, that may be where Lifestream goes. We may just have the new Lifestream Trauma Center out here. And it could be in North Carolina. Who knows where I end up?
Well, when you think about it, in some of our conversations, I mean, looking back at the things that God has taken you through over the last couple of years, let alone the last 20 years, but even just the last couple of years with some other people that have been close to you and seeing God walk through experiences of betrayal, experiences of things that were outside of your control that you couldn't change, and really seeing God step in there.
Yeah,
I mean, you've said that everything that you've gone through in your relationship with the Lord led you to this point to where you could navigate this with Sarah.
And I said that the other day, everything prepared me for this moment. If this would have come out earlier, I don't know what guy I would have been.
Yeah,
I don't know how angry I might have been and just, gosh, after all I've done for you, you want to pull this crap on me, then I'm out of here. And it was never even a thought.
Yeah.
I love that. Anger was never a thought towards Sarah. I felt like she wasn't being protected well. She wasn't in a right mind, and the people around her were treating her as if she were. And so they were trusting the things she was saying. And that's caused some collateral damage. Sarah and I both know there's collateral damage in friends and family that it's going to take God to work through. But, you know, as I've told her, man, I got you back, and that's the sweepstakes. So if other things don't get better in time, I won. I won the lottery. I've got my baby. We're in this together. We're laughing. We're celebrating. We're hurting. We're crying together. Nothing between us. Nothing negative there. Yeah. And there wasn't before. I tell this trauma therapist. There comes the rage. I can feel it. No. She's not a trauma therapist, was the thing. She pointed the trauma to me when it was caused by a close relative from her childhood. And Sarah will tell that story and how it's impacted her life for years and how it's not going to impact her anymore. We're going to get through this. And it's going to be a memory that shaped her, but not a memory that owns her. That's my hope. And that hope is coming to pass to our absolute joy, as you will see in the episodes to come. There's so much more of this story left to tell. There's so much more of the story left to tell. How we found our way back together, how our relationship has been healed, and how we've shared Sarah's journey into trauma and the healing God is bringing inside of it. But before we get there, the pain deepens for both of us. We'll pick up that story where Kyle and I left off last week. We hope our story will encourage you to be honest about the pain in your own life, as well as to see the ways God's inviting you to find his freedom and healing beyond it. Evil thrives in the darkness. While healing always comes in the light, as scary as it might look at the outset. Remember the quote Kyle and I discussed a few podcasts ago? The greatest sources of our suffering are the lies we tell ourselves. And that's true even if we don't know we're lying. We do realize this story isn't for everyone, and some may consider it too personal. But we've learned much from this journey, and reflecting on the input we've had with so many of you over the last week, we are even more aware of its value to others. And for those of you who suffered trauma in one form or another, our hearts and prayers are with you. The next Jake Colson Book Club will meet on Sunday, July 24th at 10:30 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, where we'll be discussing Chapter 4 of So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore. You can get details about that next week at lifestream.org.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.